It's the Takeaway for Monday, June 10th. I'm Tanzina Vega. Children separated from their parents, people prosecuted for helping migrants, pregnant women shackled to hospital beds.
Repeatedly, I've had people tell me that they've been treated like animals or treated worse than animals.
How do we view the humanity of people who cross the southern border? And a story of failed health care and death under ICE detention. Also on the show, YouTube is attempting to control hate speech on its platform, but will it work?
If you're relying on user reports, that's probably not going to work. If you're relying on just AI, it's pretty clear that that's not there yet. Even if in cases where the intentions are good, it's like, how are you going to be able to follow this through?
And the Women's World Cup is in full swing. We're putting a spotlight on the sexism facing the women's national teams in Brazil, Chile, and Argentina.
Those three teams historically have the greatest disparity between men's and women's national teams in the world, although women have been playing at least 100 years in all three of those countries.
We've got the essentials for you starting now. Last June, a sound captured the nation, one that's difficult to listen to, even to this day. Those are children sobbing after being separated from their parents at the southern U.S. border under the Trump administration's zero-tolerance immigration policy. That recording is from ProPublica. The policy was widely denounced as inhumane, and thousands of people around the country took to the streets to protest.
Stop taking children! Keep families out of prison! Stop taking children! Keep families out of prison! Stop taking children!
But thousands of children were separated from their parents before the Trump administration officially ended the policy. And even today, children continue to be taken from their families at the border. And the government is pushing more policies that seem to question the very humanity of the people who try to enter this country. Just recently, the Trump administration announced it would cut things like soccer and legal aid for unaccompanied children in federal custody. A man is on trial for giving aid to migrants at the southern border, as Border Patrol agents systematically destroy water bottles left in the desert for dehydrated migrants. And at least five migrant children have died in the past 7 months after crossing the border. But the mass public outcry of a year ago has largely gone quiet. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, questions of humanity at the border, more than a year since family separation. Joining me now is Javier Zamora, a poet, writer, and educator from El Salvador. Javier, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So we hear a lot of people, politicians, activists, parents, using the word inhumane. And I want to ask you, in your experience, as someone who has been a migrant to this country, have you seen a difference in the way you were treated versus the actions we're seeing today? Is what we are seeing today inhumane?
I just want to return to that word, inhumane. That means less than human. And I immigrated here in 1999, and I crossed through the Sonoran Desert. At the time, a kid couldn't be held in detention for more than a day or two. And so that was my experience. I'd never experienced, you know, jail time. And now every presidency since has increased that time. And now I would say that we are diving less and more into more inhumane practices that we're seeing today, like the family separations and everything. It has gotten worse.
And I want to bring in here, we have Aura Abogado, who's an immigration reporter for Reveal at the Center for Investigative Reporting. Aura, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Tanzina.
We're just talking to Javier Zamora about this, but this word inhumane, in your reporting, which you've done extensively on this issue, would you describe what you have seen in your reporting about this crisis at the border and children in particular as inhumane?
Well, people that I've talked to for years have certainly described it to me in that way. People who've just arrived to the United States, including children, have talked for years about hieleras or ice boxes that they're placed into by Border Patrol. They're freezing cold. They're sometimes absolutely packed to the point where you have to very carefully step over people in order to get to the toilet, which is an open-air toilet inside of the same cell that you're placed into. It's sometimes so crowded that someone has to stand on top of the toilet just for space. adults talk about detention centers where the food is a daily sandwich of moldy bread and rotten bologna. And this was recently validated by the Inspector General, who made a report on surprise visits that they made to four detention centers. Last year, you know, our publication revealed from the Center for Investigative Reporting published the first big story on massive cases of abuse that we've seen at children's shelters around the country. So that's just a little bit, you know, some of what I've heard and some of what I've reported on. And repeatedly, I've had people tell me that they've been treated like animals or treated worse than animals.
One of the things that we're also mentioning in this is that there have been activists who are now being criminalized for essentially trying to help migrants. And that's everything from leaving water in the desert and beyond. And we know that there were a group of activists who were sentenced for doing exactly that. Curious for both of you, Auda, I'd love to hear your thoughts initially on this. Is this relatively new to see humanitarian activists criminalized for their work?
It's not new. The prosecutions also go back to more than 10 years. It used to be that I used to just get a lot of hate mail, which I still get. But a lot of people, I think now more than ever, just want to know what's happening. And I think it does match up with the fact that the rhetoric from this administration is unlike anything that we've seen from prior administrations when it comes to this topic of immigration particularly.
And Javier, you're nodding. I'm wondering what you feel when you hear about these humanitarian workers who are being essentially prosecuted for their work.
I think it's the people who actually treat immigrants as humans are being rounded up now as well. And that is a problem. And now with this case, there's the fear of the changing in the language of the term harboring and transportation. That is what's at stake. And if that changes, then anybody could be prosecuted for transporting immigrants in a mixed status family, for example. And that is a huge fear that the immigration community has at the moment.
And you're saying that it's also people who help this community that are also being prosecuted. What do you think the long-term impact of that will be?
There's going to be increased fear of people who actually want to help and doing something as simple as just giving water to immigrants. Now there's going to be even a fear of incarceration for citizens as well.
Auda, one of the things, you're out here reporting and sort of having to, quote unquote, stick to the facts, right, in a lot of what we do as journalists. But the language that we use in talking about these issues are also really important. How do you as a journalist try to infuse humanity in your work when it comes to this population?
So I write about human beings, and I think that for other reporters, perhaps reporters who haven't been on the beat as long or cover national security, for example, like I've noticed that increasingly reporters who report on national security and whose best sources are in the government, particularly at Department of Homeland Security, do approach this as an enforcement issue and tend to objectivize the people who are affected by the policies that are being written about. I write from the perspective of people who experience those policies. So going back again to the Scott Warren case, who's being criminalized, the charges are harboring migrants. You know, the area that Warren works in Arizona, just last year I did a story about a group of people called Los Armadillos, which is a volunteer group that scours the desert to find remains. Last year, for example, they found remains of someone who had perished in that location in 2008, right? Totally different administration. And I do try to remember that these stories are about people. They're about human beings. They're about human beings that are making often difficult decisions to leave the places that they're from and know that they may face great peril. And I think that is also a lot of what I see with increased immigration reporting. There's always a focus on illegality. It's very difficult to find a story that doesn't say illegal or illegally as if somehow an action that someone may or may not have committed one time.
Javier, do we run the risk of becoming desensitized to this issue?
Absolutely. And to return to Aura's point of what the language that we use, what it means to be dehuman is literally means to be not human. And this language, like she's saying, we always return to the term illegal or dehumanized or animals and all these other adjectives around the whole issue of immigration, even alien, the biggest one. If a listener or a reader starts to hear these terms and you start looking at immigrants as less than human, we run the risk, and we already are there, I feel, of not having empathy, because you only have empathy for somebody that you consider a human being. And so you can't have empathy if you think that that other person's an animal.
So, Javier, we mentioned that 5 children have died after spending time in immigration custody since December. When you see those headlines, what's your initial reaction?
For me, what goes through my head, I can't help but to think back of my time when I was crossing the border. And the question that returns to me is, wow, that could have been me. And that could have been me haunts me, which is why I try to avoid the news. If I'm being honest, I try to avoid them because I've known that this has been happening. It's happening more. And I'm glad that we are covering it so much in the news. I think other people need to know. But I just wish it wasn't happening.
Is there any hope to be had at this point? Are there any bright spots in this very difficult story?
I think, you know, I've critiqued the coverage of immigration as well, but I think if I'm being hopeful about it, I like that these issues are being highlighted and highlighted by newscasts that are responsible in their terminology and their approach, which I think this program is one of those. And Aura, who is on here as well, she's doing great work. And I think that is very hopeful.
Aura talked a little bit about what it's like to be a journalist covering this and the language that we use when we're talking about the situation at the southern border. What about the images that we see?
That's a very interesting question, because in the New York Times, it's always where the camera is at. And I think Aura has also covered this. It's always from the border's point of view, from the United States point of view. So you always see images of immigrants coming at you. And if we were to change just the focus of images like that, if we were to take a picture, for example, from Mexico looking into the United States, I think the viewer would be more empathetic and would put themselves in the shoes of those immigrants. And that would be an even more hopeful idea.
I'm thinking particularly of the photo of the little girl crying that was almost iconic when mm-hmm. this policy started. Do you think that something like that helps the situation or really sheds light on what's happening?
I like the point because that was taken from the Mexico side. What I thought regarding that picture in particular was the violence around it. So when can we take a picture of an immigrant who is immigrating here without the backdrop of violence?
And trauma.
We need to show joy because humans are not only about violence and trauma, immigrants included. We need to show other complexities of the human experience because immigrants are humans as well.
Javier Zamora is a poet, writer, and educator from El Salvador, and Aura Abogado is an immigration reporter for Reveal. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Twenty-four people have died while in the custody of Immigration and Customs Enforcement since President Trump took office. And while circumstances surrounding migrant deaths are typically shrouded in secrecy, The Takeaway has obtained exclusive details about one Cuban migrant who died after being held in ICE custody last year. In January 2018, Julio Castro Garrido died of pneumonia after spending 6 weeks in the Stewart Detention Facility in rural Georgia, raising new questions about the medical treatment migrants in ICE custody receive. Jose Olivares is an associate producer here on The Takeaway, and he's going to take us through this story and what it might tell us about ICE care of detainees. Hey, Jose, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
So tell us, Jose, who was Julio Castro Garrido and why was he in ICE detention?
So Julio was a 33-year-old Cuban migrant. In 2015, he came to the United States and obtained legal residency through the Cuban Refugee Adjustment Act. According to his brother, he worked as a truck driver. And in 2016, while crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, he had a migrant in his truck. And he was arrested by border officials for, quote, attempting to transport and move an undocumented migrant. So in 2017, after spending a year in prison, he was taken to the Stewart Detention Facility, which is one of the largest ICE facilities in the entire country. It's a privately run facility run by private prison company CoreCivic, and it's located in rural Georgia.
Now, we've heard a lot about the Stewart Detention Facility. Remind some of our listeners why we know that name.
So in the time span of 14 months, there were three deaths that occurred at that facility. In May of 2017, a schizophrenic detainee killed himself after spending 19 days in solitary confinement. In January of 2018, Julio Castro Garrido died after spending 2 months at the facility. And in July of 2018, another schizophrenic detainee, Efraín Romero de la Rosa, hanged himself after spending 21 days in solitary confinement.
So there's a lot happening here at this detention facility. Jose, walk us through the lead up to Julio's death.
So when Julio first came into the Stewart Detention Facility, he had no health problems aside from a very slightly elevated blood pressure. This was in November of 2017. About a month later, he started reporting to detention staff that he wasn't feeling well, that he was kind of ill. But regardless, he still worked at the detention facility kitchen. On January 6th in 2018, he reported to the medical unit where he was diagnosed with a fever, and he was given only Benadryl and acetaminophen and allergy medicine for his illness. The following day, despite having reported his illness to the facility, despite being under CoreCivic supervision, he was still working at the detention facility kitchen, working with food, potentially transmitting his illness to the other detainees at the facility. That same day, on January 7th, during dinner, his cellmate saw that he wasn't doing well and reported to a shift supervisor that his cellmate, Julio Castro Garrido, was doing very badly. So they had to help carry him to the medical units where they finally decided to take action and call an ambulance. However, as this report notes, the CoreCivic staff, the CoreCivic supervisors, were delayed in calling the ambulance, which could have potentially delayed his access to emergency care. After he left the facility, he ended up going to three different hospitals, two in Georgia, and then his condition got so bad, his right lung collapsed. They weren't able to provide the correct procedures at these first two hospitals, so they ended up taking him to the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida, where he was with family, and he unfortunately went into a coma on January 23rd, and on January 30th, he died.
Now, Jose, you obtained a copy of the death report for Julio, and it revealed, what I found interesting was that it revealed three areas of concern, and that's what they call them, after they did their own investigation. Tell us about those areas of concern.
That's right. So the first area of concern that the ICE investigators highlight is that on December 2nd, his blood pressure was high enough for him to qualify, as the American Heart Association says, to have stage 2 hypertension. Now, when a detainee has hypertension, they are supposed to be considered special needs detainees, special needs patients, and they are required to have either alternate housing changes or changes to their labor practices at the facility. Obviously, this didn't happen with Julio, and they did not monitor his blood pressure. Now, the second area of concern, I think, is significant because on January 7th, on the same day he was taken in an ambulance to the hospital, Julio was working at the facility kitchen, potentially transmitting his illness to other detainees. Now, this is a fundamental question because last year, there was a lawsuit, a class action lawsuit filed by current and former detainees at the Stewart Detention Center saying that if they refused to take part in voluntary labor at the facility, they were threatened with punishment via solitary confinement. The third area of concern is about the prolonged time that it took for detention facility staff to call an ambulance, which could have potentially delayed his access to urgent medical care. And I spoke with Azadeh Shahshahani. She's the legal and advocacy director with Project South, and this is the organization that obtained this death review on Julio Castro Garrido. And this is what she told me.
It appeared that he wasn't getting the health care that he needed immediately, that his concerns were ignored, which is, you know, completely in line with what we're hearing about how people are being treated at the Stewart Detention Center in terms of people being sick and basically not receiving the care that they need in a timely manner.
Jose, has ICE responded to this so far? And I guess the other question is, what are their policies to prevent this type of thing from happening?
So ICE has very strict policies. And according to this report, the Stewart Detention Center did not break any of those policies. However, there is still that weird question about the ICE healthcare special needs classification that Julio should have theoretically fallen under. I reached out to ICE multiple times and they still have not responded to me. I did reach out to CoreCivic and they said that they do take care of every single person who is entrusted to their care. And they said that any questions about the labor practices at the facility are not true.
Do we have any reason to believe that these are not isolated incidents?
So under the Trump administration, we've seen a rising number of people detained by ICE and being placed in ICE custody throughout the country. Since the Trump administration took office, there have been 24 deaths in ICE custody, three since April. Now, under the Obama administration, there was an approximately 34,000 people who were detained by ICE. Now, under the Trump administration, there are approximately 52,000 people. Now, the fascinating question and what has advocates worried is that bringing in the profit motive, bringing in companies like CoreCivic or the healthcare companies that were involved at Stewart, this raises questions about the efficacy of care and if ICE is able to properly care for those in their custody.
Jose Olivares is an associate producer with The Takeaway who was able to obtain this exclusive report. Jose, thank you.
Thank you, Tanzina.
YouTube announced last week that it would be removing thousands of videos and channels that advocated neo-Nazism, white supremacy, and other bigoted ideologies. And this comes after the company failed to take action against a conservative vlogger's harassment of a gay Latino journalist, which caused a major backlash. And despite the recent scrutiny, YouTube hasn't really been in the spotlight over questions of content moderation, at least not to the same extent as Facebook and Twitter. But with 2 billion active monthly users worldwide, its influence is undeniable, and its decisions around content significant. Joining me to discuss all this is Paris Martineau, staff writer for Wired, who covers social media manipulation, online extremism, and internet culture. Paris, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So it's one thing to have rules. It's another thing to enforce them. What has YouTube been doing as far as moderating content?
That's a good question. So while YouTube has long had these community guidelines, its track record when it comes to enforcement is a bit muddled. Partially that's because YouTube is a huge platform. There are hundreds of hours of YouTube videos being uploaded every minute. And even though YouTube has quite a few content moderators and an AI team, it's hard kind of to track all of that down. But also because YouTube's financially kind of incentivized with some of this content, it makes money off of some of the videos that do the best on its platform, that sometimes it is a little slow to enforce its rules because, one, it hasn't seen it, or two, it's taking time to create a policy decision.
And you said it makes money off of content. Can you explain to us how they make money?
Yeah, so whenever you watch a YouTube video, you may notice there are ads before, in the middle, or at the end of the video, as well as the ones that pop up kind of on screen. When you see those ads, YouTube is getting a cut for the fact that you saw this ad, but as well, the creator, the person who published that video, is making money too. This is a system that YouTube introduced in around 2012 for all YouTube creators, and it had a big effect on the platform because all of a sudden anyone who was posting content to YouTube could actually use that as a revenue stream.
Tell us a little bit about the case that sort of set this whole conversation off for YouTube against this Latino blogger.
So it's actually interesting because this happened simultaneously around the same time as YouTube's policy decision, but this policy decision has actually been in the works. But last week, a Vox Latino journalist, he started tweeting out that he had been under attack by a far-right YouTube creator for quite some time who was using egregious slurs and really directly attacking him, which seemed to violate many of YouTube's policies. He had tweeted about how he'd brought it to YouTube's attention, never really had anything happen with it. The tweets went viral. Still, nothing seemed to happen until YouTube responded and said, oh, we've reviewed these videos, and while we may find some of the speech kind of offensive, they don't actually breach any of our policies on hate speech. Then YouTube, within 12 hours, announced its new policy guidelines, which you had mentioned, and shortly after said, actually, we're demonetizing this far-right creator's videos, which means taking away his ability to make money through ads. Everybody thought, oh, that's because of the slurs, the content. But then, curiously, YouTube, an hour or two after, said, oh, no, actually, the only reason we're demonetizing them is because he has a link to a shirt that has a slur in it. If he takes away those links from his YouTube channel, he can get his ads back. So it's a big mess, is the short answer.
YouTube, you know, when we talk about things like free speech and what's considered offensive and what's not, we often only focus on, we hear Facebook all the time, we hear Google, we hear Twitter, but we don't hear a lot about YouTube. Why is that?
Yeah, it's quite a shame. I think it's because in regards to like Facebook and Twitter, the average age of users is quite a bit higher. People's parents and grandparents use those sort of platforms. They're part of everyday discourse, but generally the median age for a YouTube user is going to be lower, millennials, Gen Z. This is where they get all of their not only like news and political content, but their culture content. But the fact is that YouTube has grown so large and had such a outsized presence among these groups that it really needs to be talked about more, because while it is not as easily searchable as, say, Twitter or Facebook or publicly accessible and requires watching an hour-long video to get the gist, it's just as influential, if not more, because of the financial incentives.
So how big is YouTube?
YouTube is huge. It is one of the biggest sites on the web, basically. It has more than 2 billion monthly active users.
Billion with a B.
With a B. Billion with a B. It's huge. YouTube's traffic is estimated to be like one of the second highest of any website, behind only Google.com, which once again owns YouTube. So it's Google, then it's YouTube.
One of the things that came up as we were thinking about this segment, right, was thinking about how when it comes to content, YouTube, Google, Facebook have all sort of, they've all said, we're not media companies. We're tech companies, right? And I think that raises an interesting issue for how these companies, because they want to remain tech companies, not media companies, will determine what content can and can't be on their sites, right? Mm-hmm. And what I mean is, for example, we are media people. We have, you know, ethical boundaries and considerations and reasons why we publish and don't publish. But these companies, YouTube, Google, they don't have the same obligation. So could this become the beginning of a slippery slope of censorship?
I think that's an interesting question, especially because the same thing has, of course, been raised in relation to Facebook and Twitter. And it's this large kind of ethical, media ethical gray area that we still haven't been able to figure out. What do you say to a company that says it's a tech company, says it's a platform, but yet when it sees neo-Nazi videos starting to pop up and its platform being used to spread terrorist content or things that endanger children, and they say, okay, yeah, we want to make sure that doesn't get on there, or the things that lead to those bad things don't get on there. Does that mean they're exercising editorial control? Should we, I don't know, villainize editorial control or put it to this high of a standard where by policing or moderating what appears in their own site, they now have all these extra responsibilities? Because then that disincentivizes moderation entirely. And that's problematic because obviously, as we've seen, when you tie like financial gains and this kind of ability to create, you get increasingly more and more extreme content. And that's good for really no one. I mean, except for probably these platforms' bottom lines, because the more people you have watching this content and interacting with the ads, you get more money, but it's not good for people generally.
Again, I think about the issue of whack-a-mole. It feels like the minute you put one side out, there's another site that's ready to go, right? Because the idea of these, you mentioned YouTube has 2 billion users. That's a lot of people.
That's monthly active users too.
Right. And so all those people can create their own content. And how are these companies expected to put out all this content on the fly?
Yeah, so I mean, that was the issue that I kind of took with YouTube's announcement last week in regards to the changes in the content policy. While on paper, it's good, it's also, the announcement was kind of lacking in any details regarding how this enforcement and identification was going to happen. It's one thing to say you have these policies, but how are you going to proactively identify these videos. Let's say the people who are espousing coded neo-Nazi views are only doing so to their followers who know exactly what that means and don't want to report the content. If you're relying on user reports, that's probably not going to work. If you're relying on just AI, it's pretty clear that that's not there yet. Content moderators aren't paid enough to be able to do their job effectively, nor are there enough of them. So it just seems like even if in cases where the intentions are good, it's like, how are you going to be able to follow this through?
Paris Martineau is a staff writer for Wired. Paris, thanks so much for your reporting.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Women's World Cup is underway in France. The United States kicks off tomorrow against underdog Thailand. But first, we turn to our neighbors to the south. Argentina is playing their first Women's World Cup game since 2007 today. It's been a hard-fought journey for the Albicelestes to make it back to the tournament. In fact, all three South American teams, the others are Chile and Brazil, have recently taken drastic measures in the face of decades-long systematic discrimination to get where they are today. Brenda Elsey is an associate professor of history at Hofstra University and co-host of the feminist sports podcast Burn It All Down. And I sat down with her to talk about the troubles facing the women's game in Brazil, Argentina, and Chile, especially as those countries' men's teams are so dominant.
Those three teams historically have the greatest disparity between men's and women's national teams in the world, meaning between resources and ranking, between their men's side and their women's side, although women have been playing at least 100 years in all three of those countries.
100 years?
Mm-hmm.
So why these disparities?
Well, the closer that football became connected with the national identity and the idea that soccer somehow developed proper masculinity, the further that women were pushed away from it. And so as it became really important in social life, in cultural life, and even in local politics, because the clubs there wield a lot of power. And by the 1940s and 50s, it was very evident that women were threatening. Women playing soccer were threatening.
Threatening to who and why?
So threatening to the patriarchal football governance structures, so the federations, the clubs. Threatening in the sense of getting out of the domestic space and into the public space, claiming time for themselves, claiming leisure for themselves. And then the very idea that a woman player could represent the nation was absolutely radical. It is still radical.
Soccer governing bodies have banned women until the 1970s. Is that different than what happened in South America?
It is.
And how?
Well, so in the English case, for example, it's the federation that bans women's soccer. In the case of Brazil, in South America, the only ban you have is Brazil, the only official ban, which comes in 1941 under the authoritarian government of Getúlio Vargas. And what that means is that it's illegal in the country for women to play soccer. Even when they had invitations to play in Uruguay and in Argentina, the women went to the courts to seek permission saying, well, women's soccer is not illegal there, and they were still turned down. And that ban stays in place until 1981, and that does pretty phenomenal amounts of damage to the development of the programs. Women's soccer wasn't the only sport that was banned. There were also rugby, water polo, all in the name of their quote-unquote maternal health, that it was to protect women from themselves, from their own ideas of fun, which were dangerous to creating proper maternal vessels. But it's team sports that are most threatening. You don't see women's tennis going through this or anything else.
Since the 2015 Women's World Cup, each of these countries we're talking about, Argentina, Chile, and Brazil, have all taken different approaches to protesting their federations. Can you tell us a little bit about what those were?
It has been nothing short of astonishing what the women have accomplished since 2015. In 2015, essentially, after the Women's World Cup, all three of those teams just sort of sank in terms of their activity. In the case of Argentina and Chile, they actually became unranked. So that means after the 125 teams, they are at the absolute bottom, meaning that the federation doesn't accept invitations. They don't have official matches. They don't know if they have coaches. They don't know what's happening. And this has everything to do with the very dynamic feminist movement, Ni Una Menos, in Latin America, it became a sort of cause celeb among, you know, feminists. And there became this sort of grassroots relationship in all three of these countries, and it actually is very transnational as well. So in the case of Chile in 2016, they formed what's called ANJUF, which is an association that links up with the men's union, the men's players professional union, which has a lot of support to give. That was one approach that they took. And then in the case of Argentina, they had a general strike in 2017. They make $8.50 a day when they train. And the strike was not even to raise the wages. It was actually because the Federation had not paid those wages. And since then, the Argentine women have just organized. When they won't listen to them off the pitch, they've started to protest on the pitch. So during the Copa America of 2018, which is how they qualified for this World Cup, they did a very powerful sort of team photo where they're all cupping their ears and asking to be heard. And the Brazilians, much the same thing. In 2017, a series of protests, they took a little bit of a different track again. In 2016, they had actually had their first woman coach, Emily Lima, who was, after 7 wins and 5 losses, fired and then quickly replaced with their old coach. And the reaction was just like boiling over, like, this is just too much. And so there was a series of retirements, protest letters, and things like that.
Also, one of the things that you're hearing, I know, from women in South America who are fighting for this, they're calling it feminist football. What's different between feminist football and women's soccer? Or women's football, I'm sorry.
Yeah, so the translation there would be football femenino, or like really women's football, or football feminista, feminist football, or soccer. And the reason for that is that as the women started to gain traction over the last couple of years, many of the grassroots women's organizers said, hey, this is all great. This attention is all great. We love the women's national team. But you know what? We don't want to start emulating the men's game. What we want to do is find an alternative path to objectification of players, mass export of players, poorly run academies that have ended up with youth players, you know, getting hurt. You know, they've said we need a sort of not so corporatized model that just repeats a patriarchal structure that we've suffered from. So things like including gender non-binary or trans players and addressing those really difficult issues instead of just sort of inserting women into the global game.
Brenda Elsie is an associate professor of history at Hofstra University and co-host of the feminist sports podcast, Burn It All Down. She's also co-author of the new book, Futbolera, A History of Women and Sports in Latin America, and the development lead for the Americas at FAIR. Brenda, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We just heard about the sexism facing South American women's soccer teams, but this is also a time to celebrate one of the biggest sporting events for women. And lots of you have World Cup fever.
Hi, it's Barbara calling from Red Bluff, California, and I'm up here in the region of Megan Rapinoe. She is fierce and indomitable, and we are so proud of her. Go, Megan Rapinoe.
I'm looking forward to the World Cup, and I'm excited about the U.S. women's national team. Carly Lloyd, Alex Morgan, and the rest dominate the others and should squeak out some close wins to make it to the final. Go USA!
The United States will play their first game of the tournament against Thailand tomorrow. Tell us what you're excited about for this World Cup on Twitter. We're at The Takeaway. All right, that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.